Welcome to Live, Love, Engage, the podcast where we share practical advice from a spiritual perspective on how to create a life and business with more impact, influence, and income. I am your host, Gloria Grace Rand, the insightful copywriter and founder of The Love Method. My mission is to help you stop doubting yourself so you can live fully, love deeply, and engage authentically. Namaste and welcome to Live, Love, Engage. I am Gloria Grace Rand. And today on our show, I am delighted to have an awesome person who, a gentleman who has got a lot of unique experience, including being a comedian, who also talks about a subject that you wouldn't necessarily find funny. But he has found a way to be able to help people out with it. So first off, I want to welcome to Live, Love, Engage, Frank King. And for those of you not watching on YouTube, he was waving and smiling. So,
yeah.
But let me tell you a little bit about this gentleman. He is a suicide prevention speaker and trainer, who also was a writer for The Tonight Show for 20 years. And depression and suicide actually run in his family. And he's had to deal with that. And we'll talk a little bit more about that. But having to deal with depression and wanting to kill himself. But on the other hand, he was able to turn that long, dark journey of the soul into 5 TEDx Talks.
Woo!
That's quite amazing in and of itself, something I haven't even done one yet, so kudos to you.
Thank you.
And not only that, he's a motivational public speaker who uses his life lessons to start a conversation, to give people permission to give voice to their feelings and experiences surrounding depression and suicide. And that is so important right now because as we're recording this, it's the end of September 2020, and I was actually just doing some research on this yesterday that because of the pandemic, that as of at least late June, there was some research done that 40% of U.S. adults reported that they were struggling with mental health or substance abuse. So I think this is a time where really I think people are struggling. So it's great that you're able to use humor and to be able to help people. So let's maybe start from the beginning a little bit and just talk a little bit about your own journey and how did you even get started in comedy?
Well, I was in fourth grade and I told my first joke and the students laughed and more importantly, the teacher was hysterical. And I thought, I'm going to be a comedian. And then 12th grade, they had a talent show. Nobody had ever done stand-up at the senior talent show before. It's 1975. I did stand-up. I won. I went home, told my mama, I'm going to be a comedian. And she goes, son, you're going to college. You can do whatever you like when you're done. You can be a goat herder for all I care. But you, my son, are going to be a goat herder with a college degree.
Mm-hmm.
So I went to UNC Chapel Hill, actually a BA and a BS, and then moved to San Diego with my high school and college sweetheart, where we got married. And big mistake, because she's a wonderful woman, but we had absolutely nothing in common. Mm. You know what they say, opposites attract. She was pregnant, I wasn't. So I'm kidding, we never had children. And just by chance, in San Diego, there was a branch of the world-famous Comedy Store that's on Sunset in Los Angeles. Mm. And every time I drove by that place, I felt this magnetic pull. Mm. My first wife was not a big fan of comedy, especially not a big fan of me becoming a comedian. Mm. Well, because she married an insurance guy, got a comedian, kind of a matrimonial bait and switch. So I essentially had to sneak out. You know, most guys sneak out to a strip bar or something. I had to sneak out to open mic night at the Comedy Store. And then I got a job seating and greeting so I could watch, you know, the comics, the professional comedians. And back then, Jim Carrey was headlining just doing impressions. Andrew Dice Clay, Ellen DeGeneres, Rosie O'Donnell, Paul Poundstone, Dennis Miller. And so I watched and soaked in, you know, some of the best comedy available.
Right.
And let's see. And I got up on stage first time 1984, April Fool's Day. Mm. Did my first 5 minutes. Everybody laughed. And I heard inside my head, I'm home. Mm. I'm going to do this for a living. I have absolutely no idea how. A year later, I'd actually booked myself on the road 10 weeks. It was kind of the beginning of the big comedy club boom from 85 to about 95. And I said to my girlfriend, now my wife of 33 years, I'm going on the road to be a stand-up comedian professionally. Do you want to come along? Anticipating, of course, she'd go, no. And she goes, yeah. So we quit our jobs, gave up our apartment, put everything we couldn't fit into our little Dodge Colt into storage. And we were on the road, she and I, for 2,629 nights in a row, nonstop.
Wow.
7 years and change. I came off the road to work in radio in my old hometown of Raleigh, North Carolina, where I took a number one morning show and drove it to number six in 18 months. I only drove it in the ground, drove it into Middle Earth. And by the time that was over, the comedy club scene was beginning to wane. Mm. However, I'd always been very clean as a comedian, so I made the jump to the corporate comedy circuit, the after dinner, after lunch, rubber chicken circuit, and made a great living doing that for about 10 years until the recession.
Mm.
And then my business dropped off 80% overnight. We filed Chapter 7 bankruptcy, lost everything we'd worked for in 25 years, and that's when I learned what the barrel of my gun tasted like.
Oh, wow.
Spoiler alert, I did not pull the trigger. Mm. I say that, I tell that joke at all my keynotes, and people are laughing, but you can see they're thinking, should we be laughing at this?
Yeah.
A friend of mine was at a keynote back earlier this year, and he never heard me say that out loud about not pulling the trigger. And he came up and he goes, hey, man, how come you didn't pull the trigger? I go, hey, man, could you try to sound a little less disappointed? if you want to know why I didn't pull the trigger, it's in my first TEDx talk, A Matter of Laugh or Death. Mm. Depression and suicide run in my family. It's called Generational Depression and Suicide. Mm. I have two mental illnesses, major depressive disorder, depression, and something called chronic suicidal ideation, much more rare. Wow. It means for me and people in my tribe, the option of suicide is always on the menu as a solution for problems large and small. When I say small, my car broke down a couple of years ago. I had three thoughts unbidden. Get it fixed, buy a new one, or I could just kill myself. That is chronic suicidal ideation in a nutshell. Mm. And every time I've spoken, except once, there's been somebody in the audience who had that. They were unaware it had a name. They thought they were just some kind of freak, and because of the way their brain worked. And it came as a revelation that, no, you're not alone. There are lots of us out there. And that's one of the reasons I do what I do. And that's very therapeutic for me, to reveal to someone that they, in fact, are not alone. Because it's possible I've steered them just far enough off the path to suicide, they'll live a normal life.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that's, it definitely helps to know that you're not alone when you're going through something like that. So that's awesome that you're able to help people. Well, it seemed like we covered a lot of your background, but how did you wind up working for The Tonight Show then?
When I was on the road all those days, nights, Jay Leno was permanent guest host for Johnny. Mm. And Johnny, very mercurial, would tell the staff on a Friday night, I'm taking next week off,
which meant,
back then, Best of Carson rerun Monday. That meant Jay had 4 days, four nights of monologues to write, 18 jokes per monologue, and that's a lot of comedy. So what he started doing was hiring road comedians, such as myself, to write, and I was sending in a dozen, two dozen jokes by fax back in the day, travel with a fax machine, actually. Faxing in dozen, two dozen jokes a day. And I was getting on a couple a week in the monologue when he was filling in. And then when he got the job for real, they cut loose a lot of the contract labor, but they kept me on. And I rode that horse until he, you know, exited the Tonight Show. I can't remember what year it was, but it was about 20 years total.
Wow, that's amazing. Well, congrats, because that's an accomplishment in itself to be able to do that. Were you struggling with depression at all during that time, or was that, or how did that fit into how you've been able to, you know, cope with your life? Yeah.
My fourth TEDx talk is called Suicide, The Secret of My Success, Ed Mann Talking. And I coach TEDx, and I tell my students, look, here's the deal. They get a couple hundred applications. So whatever you put down as title, subtitle, or 10-word elevator pitch has got to pique their interest. Mm. And so Suicide, the Secret of My Success is somewhat counterintuitive.
Right.
And then Dead Man Talking is a play on Dead Man Walking.
Yeah.
And it was good enough, title, subtitle, and the idea, they called me up and said, no, you don't have to audition. You're just going to be on the show. Mm. The Suicide Secret of My Success, as I mentioned, my first wife was not a fan of me being a comedian. She actually actively discouraged it. And so I realized several years into the marriage, because I felt like, you know, she's a wonderful woman, but we really didn't belong together. And I was selling insurance, which is a great business, but it wasn't for me. And I realized that I was depressed and suicidal. And if I didn't change something in soon, I was going to kill myself. My second thought was very empowering. I thought, well, wait a minute. I could divorce my wife, quit my job, try comedy, which I thought was what I was born to do.
Right.
If it works, great. If not, I can still kill myself. And by the way, I thought I was the only one on the planet who thought that way, as many people with mental illness do. Mm-hmm. And I've met a goodly number of comedians and entrepreneurs who had the very same thought process. They're living a life they don't feel like they belong. Not really my life. I need to be over there doing, following their dream. Mm-hmm. And so they had the very same, you know, if I don't change something, I'm going to kill myself. Well, what the heck? I might as well change. If it doesn't work out, I can always kill myself. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of, in a sad way, my superpower is that if things get too bad, and it actually keeps me alive.
Yeah.
Because I know that if things get, the pain gets too bad, and suicide is all about pain, people go, why do you want to kill himself? Chances are he didn't. He probably just wanted to end the pain. Mm-hmm. If pain gets too bad, I'm sitting in the exit row on an airplane in the window seat, and I can pull that handle anytime I like. Mm-hmm. It came in handy 2 weeks ago because we live in an area where there was a wildfire not far away, and level one is get ready, level two is get set, level three is go and don't take anything with you. Mm. Wildfires move very quickly.
Right.
So I'm in town 25 minutes from the house, and we're at level one. And then I get an alert on my phone, we're at level three. I'm like, what happened to level two? Oh, what happened geez. To get set?
Yeah.
We have 11 cats. And so I drove back into level three. Fire's a mile and a quarter away. Police are going down the street with their lights flashing and blowing the horn, telling everybody to get out and, you know, just get out now. Don't take anything with you.
Right, right. And
we're like the Marine Corps in that we never leave anybody behind.
Yeah.
So I'm in the house stuffing cats into carriers. I have all due respect, by the way, for the term herding cats.
Yeah.
And a friend of mine said, well, you drove back into essentially a fire to rescue cats? And I go, you could have died. I go, here's the deal. I've been trying to kill myself for 40 years. If I'm going to die, it's going to be doing something worthwhile.
That's true.
So I drove back out into the fire and rescued all the kitties.
Well, that's good. As a cat lover myself, with owning of two cats, I'm glad you did that. It's important to take. Ooh.
This is Snugs, one of our rescues.
Ah, very pretty. Mm. Very nice.
But yeah, that's the suicidal, that's the superpower side of suicide. It helped me make the jump from insurance guy who was horribly miserable to comedian. And that I rode that for quite a while. Mm. I took a supplement called SAMe, SAM-E. It's good on mild depression. That helped. And when I turned 60, my wife goes, just talk to the doctor, get a little something. So I got a psychotropic. And 3 weeks later, I'm thinking, what was I waiting for?
Okay.
It didn't make me giddy, but it did take the edge off. So.
Yeah. Well, that's what I was going to ask you. Because, like, how did you ever find out that you did have this suicide ideation? So.
Well, my thoughts had always been like that. Mm-hmm. You know, sitting on the track, I'm looking down the track of the train, thinking if I pull in the tracks now, we're done. Or it's very common for people to say, you know, I'm driving down the highway. I see a bridge abutment ahead, and I'm thinking to myself, it's been a bad day. If I just turn the wheel a little, I could hit that bridge abutment. Those are suicidal ideation kinds of thoughts. Mm. And somebody goes, how do you know you're suicidal? Well, the taste of the gun barrel was a big tip. Because, I mean, I had time, place, and method selected. I was, you know, I was going to, unfortunately, well, fortunately, I guess, my life insurance, I hadn't passed the 2-year mark on the suicide clause. So mm-hmm. if I kill myself in 22 months, my wife wouldn't get anything. So I had to wait 2 months to kill myself again, because I knew I could do it at 2 months and a day. I sailed through 2 months knowing, and if it doesn't get any better, she gets $1 million.
Mm, wow. So what actually prompted you to do the TEDx talk for the first time that you did that? How did you, what was behind that?
Well, my lovely wife, I'd always wanted to speak and not just be funny, but to make a living and a difference. Okay. I just could never figure out what I was going to talk about. What did I have to teach anybody? And after I came so close to killing myself, and after I looked at my family history, mm-hmm. I thought, you know what, I could talk on suicide prevention. So I took a number of classes. So I'd have takeaways and action items.
Right.
And the trick was, everybody thought of me as a comedian, all the bookers and event planners and whatever. So I had to rebrand. Mm-hmm. And my wife goes, how about a TEDx? And I said, what's a TEDx? Just by chance, I got an email invite to apply to one in Vancouver, BC, British mm-hmm. Columbia. And I got it. And so that allowed me to rebrand as not a funny speaker, but a speaker who is funny. Mm-hmm. And I discovered in preparation for it that although one person dies by suicide every 11 minutes in the U.S., mm-hmm. hardly anybody talks about it. But if you bring it up, almost everyone has a mental health story. Mm-hmm. That's why the title was A Matter of Life or Death. The theme of my TEDx was start the conversation on suicide. And that's what my clients often tell me. Look, Frank, we just brought you in here to start the conversation on suicide, to give other people permission to give voice to their feelings and experiences without recrimination.
Right.
Because there's a lot of stigma. There's stigma attached to mental illness and another stigma attached to thoughts of suicide.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. And it does seem like, I mean, I would say I even had briefly thoughts when I was a teenager, because I grew up in, number one, being a teenager, you know, you're always, it's an emotional time anyway. But of course, I also grew up, I had an alcoholic father, and, you know, and my mother had her own demons and stuff. So, you know, the thought did cross my mind briefly, but not enough to act on it. But then I also remember in school, there was some kid who did commit suicide when I was in high school. And this is back in, you know, late 1970s. But today it just seems like, well, and again, it's like I was doing research, like the last 20 years, suicide rate has been going up. It's so, especially climbing for young people in particular, mm-hmm. it seems like. So what, are you doing any particular, you know, trying to reach out to be able to help young people in particular?
Well, I speak in colleges. 3 college students a day, every day, die by suicide. 3 a day.
Wow.
Mm. And in terms of high school, I think the second leading cause of death for young people aged 15 to 24 is suicide. Mm. And there's a seems to be a strange connection between, in 2012, the ownership of smartphones, a percentage of Americans who own smartphones crossed the 50% mark. Mm. And since then, the rates of teen suicide, teen self-reported depression, and smartphone ownership have tracked.
Oh, wow.
So there's no science that says there's a correlation.
Right.
But I can't believe there's not a connection there somewhere.
Yeah, yeah.
So I do colleges, and I always want to do high schools, because I think if you can catch people in high school, catch them early on, especially yeah. before they go to college.
Right.
Then you've got a much better chance, a much better outcome long term. Mm-hmm. So a friend of mine, but the problem is high schools have very small budgets for this kind of thing. And so I really can't take high school bookings, because I might get booked for a full fee engagement somewhere. So a friend of mine set up a Zoom call yesterday. Mm-hmm. And what he's been doing is, and it's brilliant, as a motivational speaker, what he would do is he would get 7 to 10 high schools together, and they'd all come to a stadium.
Yeah.
So the high schools pool their budgets.
Okay, yeah.
And bring in speakers. And he was just doing motivation back then. Mm-hmm. But he decided, you know what? I could do my motivational 30 minutes, and I could have a roster of speakers mm-hmm. covering topics of interest to young people.
Right.
And let the group of schools pick which ones they want to see. Mm. Of course, for me, it's the suicide prevention. And then I also do one on digital media addiction.
Yeah.
So I'll be on the roster. And if the schools decide they like suicide prevention, mm-hmm. then I would go and I'd be part of that, you know, that event with 7 to 10 high schools. So I think it's brilliant because one school doesn't have the money, but if you bring 7 schools together in a stadium, make a big event out of it, music, mm-hmm. you know.
Yeah.
I think he finally split the atom on how do you get in front of high school students and still make a living.
So. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that's smart. I like that. Well, I hope that will come to pass. And as we go into, now that some schools are getting back into having in-person classes, but there's still some are doing virtual with this pandemic. As we're recording this, it's the end of September, and we've been involved in this for so long. But is there anything that you, maybe advice that you have for, in particular, entrepreneurs? Because that is who I believe are my audience anyway.
Yeah.
And because I know running a business can be extremely stressful, especially when you're just getting started and launching it. And in a way, I mean, you've been, in a sense, getting your business, because it's speaking is still a business, yeah. and you're having to do that. So what kind of advice would you have for entrepreneurs in regards to being able to, I guess, maybe manage their stress?
Well, and that's something that worries me. There are several studies out that say that in addition to 47,000 people who died by suicide last year, mm-hmm. another 50, 60, 70,000 may die this year of what they call deaths of despair. Mm. And entrepreneurs worry me in particular. And a lot of people don't know this, but roughly 40% of the GDP, the gross national product, the gross domestic product, mm-hmm. are small businesses and entrepreneurs.
Right.
That's a big slice. I mean, healthcare is 25%.
Yeah.
But entrepreneurs and small business people are 40%.
Mm.
And as you said, it's difficult enough in good times.
Right. Yeah.
I've been speaking, I've been doing podcasts and webinars. I have a speech or keynote called Social Distancing and Staying Sane.
Mm.
Don't worry about your mentally ill friends. And the reason you shouldn't worry about your mentally ill friends is because having a mental illness, you wake up in an uncertain world every morning.
Right.
And so those of us who are high functioning, medication therapy, we have coping mechanisms. And I've been teaching neuronormal people how mentally ill people cope.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very simple. It's 5 things I do. I have it's called a self-care plan. Diet, I'm on the keto diet and I do intermittent fasting. Exercise, behind this green screen here, there's an old fashioned Nordic track. It's practically coal fired. It's so old. And little stretchy bands to push up things.
Yeah.
So diet, exercise, good night's sleep, meditation, medication. And I tell people, you know, there are probably thousands and thousands of people who for the first time in their lives are actually experiencing what's called situational depression.
Mm.
They are, I get it as part of the way I'm, it's organic.
Hard. Yeah.
They have it because of this uncertainty, and right. they may not recognize what it is because they've never had it before.
Mm-hmm.
So I always advise that you know, if you're feeling the stress, get a telemedicine appointment and get an evaluation. Is it situational depression? And then if medication is indicated, you know, you could take it for 6 months, 9 months until this passes and mm-hmm. then taper off. It's not like you're going to be on it the rest of your life because, you know, chances are you're neuronormal or neurotypical, and you're not going to need them after a certain point. They ask a guy who's in the space station for a year by himself, yeah. except for when they deliver groceries.
Right.
How do you make it? How do you make it? I mean, talk about social isolation.
Yeah, that's
it's
true.
One word, routine.
Yep.
So that's what I teach people is, look, you need to, even though you don't have to go to work,
yes.
you need to go to bed same time, get up same time, meal same time, meditation same time, plan your fun time. You need a routine. You need to control the things you can control, which is what people with mental illness try to do is they then let the rest of it go. The metaphor somebody gave me was, okay, Frank, if I told you to run 20 miles, I think I can do that. It's going to take a while, but I could probably do it. And at the 15-mile mark, I know it's 3/4 of the way done, and I think I can probably make the last 5. So what if I said to you, Frank, run. How far am I going? Don't know. When can I stop? I got no idea.
Yeah.
I'm going to be a little more stressed.
Absolutely.
Because, you know, with 9/11, it all happened one day and we began to recover. This thing, there's this and the surge, is it coming back? And what about flu season? And
I know. Yeah, exactly. It's
So it's important that you have a self-care plan and you have a routine and like a family routine. I should sit everybody down at the dining table, buy a whiteboard and sketch out everybody's routine in the family. So, you know, we're all on the same page because, you know, parents now find themselves, they're teachers and they weren't really trained to teach. And yes. Are the kids going back to school? If they go back to school, they're going to be back home in a week because my alma mater, UNC Chapel Hill, they were back a week.
Yeah.
And boom. Mm-hmm. And everybody's back online.
Mm-hmm.
I know. I worry about the folks who are neuronormal and are for the first time in their lives experiencing this. Although here's the upside, I think. After this is over, a lot of those people will have a lot more respect and understanding of what depression looks and feels like.
Mm, that's true.
It won't be so much of that pull yourself up by your bootstraps kind of nonsense.
Yeah. That's true. Yeah. So let's hope so that there is going to be a lot more understanding for people in that way. I'm trying to think what, I know you mentioned earlier also like one of your, when you were talking about the correlate, well, maybe let's say the tracking of smartphones and suicides going up and things for young people. What do you, I know a lot of people talk about social media and sort of the, it does have some positive aspects, but there's also been, you know, rise in like bullying and things like that.
Oh, yeah.
What is your take on how social media harms or helps, I suppose, our mental health?
Well, it's a tool like anything else. It can be used for good or evil. Mm-hmm. And as a 63-year-old guy, I can never understand... Sorry, hang on. Hold that thought. East Lane Veterinary. Hey, I'll have to call you back. I'll call you back. Veterinarian. As you might imagine, with 14 animals, those happen quite frequently.
Yeah.
A 63-year-old male, here's the thing about cyberbullying. Mm-hmm. As a 63-year-old male, or 63-year-old person, mm-hmm. when I was a kid, it was all very, very much up close and, you know, in your face and they hit you in the shoulder in the gym. But back then when you left the school, you left the bully behind.
Yeah, that's true.
Now the young people take it home in their pocket. And I had an episode in February where a lot of folks online, trolls, I guess, took umbrage at something I did.
Mm.
And I ended up having to change my home phone number and shut down 3 social media accounts. I mean, I had people publishing a map to my house, and it was horrible, the things they said to me. And I thought to myself, you know, these are people I don't know, will never see.
Yeah.
But if I was a young person in high school, the people coming after me would undoubtedly be people that I was going to high school with. How do you go back and face that day after day, you know, that kind of abuse? And I think the way to begin to deal with it is screen time. We did a keynote, a group of us did a keynote for the Michigan school superintendents. And we said, look, there's a function on your iPhone or smartphone that tells you how much time you spend every week on the iPhone. Mm. You know, knowledge is power. Just open it up, go to that function and see how long and decide for yourself. Is it too long? Is it not long enough?
Right.
And then I think parents have to, you know, take control and they have to set an example.
That's true.
You know, tell the kid to put the phone down when you're sitting at the dining room table with the phone.
Yeah.
I believe that they should have a power strip in the bedroom, the adults should, and every device in the house that's able to get a signal should be plugged into that thing as a time certain in the evening and not taken out of there until a time certain in the morning. And turn off the router so there's no Wi-Fi signal in the house.
Right, right.
It's just a matter of, again, they need to lead by example. And I'm as guilty as anybody else. I lost my iPhone while I was doing yard work in this sort of brushy area in the backyard, and I can't find it. And I had no idea how much I depended on it until it was gone.
Oh, yeah.
And I'm on the phone. The T-Mobile opens up at 4 a.m. Pacific. At 4:01, I was on the phone. I've got insurance. I need another phone. So yeah, it's one of those things that it's unfortunately young people these days. When we were kids, you were a big dog on campus if you were dating a cheerleader, or if you were a young woman and you were dating the high school quarterback. Mm. Those were the metrics.
Yeah.
Nowadays, it's likes, shares, connections, follows. A friend of mine who's 27, I guess, he goes, if I saw a gorgeous woman on Facebook and she had 500 followers, and there was another woman on Facebook who was not quite so pretty, but she had 5,000 followers, I'm going to ask the 5,000. I'm going to ask her out. Hmm. That's the metric.
Yeah.
That's how people judge themselves, likes, shares, followers, yeah. Connections. So I think it's a matter of education, and the schools are debating, should we take the phones away from the kids? Or make it against the rules for the phone to leave your locker during school hours.
Yeah.
And some schools have. The catch is, some people say, well, what if they have to get in touch with their parents, or their parents have to get in touch with them, or if there's an active shooter? You know what? When I was in high school, there was a public address system.
Yeah, that's right.
You know, it would crackle in the morning with morning announcements. And then if something went wrong or we had to do something or whatever, they would announce it.
That's
if
right.
If your parent needs you, they call the office. They would send an office to sit down. Mm-hmm. Excuse me, I need to talk to. So I believe those things should be shut in the lockers and not come out until the school day is over.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree 100%. Yeah. Because, yeah, I grew up the same way. Our parents managed to get a hold of us if they needed to. And people were, and we got to communicate. So,
You know, you don't need a text to say active shooter. All you got to do is go on the loudspeaker and go active shooter, and everybody locks down.
Yeah, exactly. So, frankly, I think it's faster that way anyway.
Then
you can react as opposed to having your face in your screen, and then you have to go deal with something.
One last thing about parents and kids in this situation is the parents need to remember what it was like to be a child. Mm. When your teenager comes home and they've broken up with their first boyfriend or girlfriend and they're devastated.
Yeah.
I think adults don't remember just how devastating. Mm-hmm. You know, they try to minimize. It's just puppy love. You know, you'll date a lot of people in the time. You have to remember exactly how devastating that. I remember. My first girlfriend broke up. You know, I was just dead. Every song on the radio was about breaking up, it seemed.
Oh, I know.
So they need to put themselves, rather than say, you know, fight back with your words or, you know, whatever. You need to, empathy, I guess, is what's missing.
Yes. Yeah, that's true. Yeah, absolutely. Yes. I remember listening to a lot of Barry Manilow when I was a kid.
Loving you is wrong, I don't want to be right.
That's right. Yeah, absolutely. If someone wants to learn a little bit more about you, or maybe they want to even be able to, you know, book you for a TEDx talk not a TEDx talk, but maybe have you come to their high school or come to their organization and speak, what's the best way for people? That's right. What's the best way for people to get a hold of you?
Well, you can go to thementalhealthcomedian.com or just type in thementalhealthcomedian in your Google box. Mm. And all my stuff, all my social media, all my stuff will come up.
Okay.
I've got a book. We have a 4-book series on men's mental health. We're book 2 just came out, but we're working on book 3 and 4. And if you go to the Mental Health Comedian and put in an email address, you can download the audiobook for free.
Awesome.
MP3, I voiced it. I narrated it.
Very good.
And my email is there at the Mental Health Comedian, my phone number. I tell people, look, if you're suicidal, call the lifeline or text 741, text the word help, 741-741. Mm. If you just had a really bad day, call a crazy person. And I put my cell phone number up on the screen because we're less likely to judge. You know, we're not going to tell you what you should be doing. We're just going to listen and co-sign whatever nonsense, you know, you're going.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's kind of like peer counseling. That's why peer counseling is so powerful. Mm-hmm. Nobody has to explain anything to anybody.
Yeah.
And nobody judges, and nobody, you know, you should do this and you should do that. And you should try fish oil.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, so it's you're welcome to call me, text me. People do all the time. I will tell you this. And I learned this from my mother. I turn my cell phone off at night because my mother used to say, she used to take the phone off the hook at night. She goes, look, here's the deal, honey. It's never good news at 2 a.m.
This is true.
You need to get a good night's sleep and deal with whatever it is the next day. So if you call me and you get the machine, just leave a message. As soon as I get up, I'll call you back.
Your mother was a very wise woman.
Oh, she was. Yeah, she was. And one of the most amazing people I've ever. And my dad died very young. So I was raised by Southern women, you know, the Steel Magnolias. Mm-hmm. And she nobody teaches you how to parent. Here's my favorite, Dixie was her name. Mm. Here's my favorite Dixieism. Mom, you know, do something stupid. Mom, do you still love me? Oh, honey, I will always love you. I don't like you much right now. It's brilliant. There's a bed of love.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, and but I don't like, so you know you're loved.
Yes.
But I don't like you much right now.
I love it. Very good. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I think I've said that similar things to,
it's brilliant.
If not my kids, maybe my husband. I don't know.
Yeah, you know, because you have this, you're undergirded by this love.
Yeah.
So you know that, you set that out right away.
Yeah.
I always love
it. Yeah.
And then my wife would call that, was it something before you lower the boom? Something about doing you something really, say something sweet and then lower the boom. So anyway, she was wise. She was very wise in that way for somebody. I mean, most, you know, this is the 60s and most who had parenting classes back then. So
this is true. Yeah.
Soften the blow before you lower the boom. That's it. Soften the blow.
Ah, there we go. Yeah. So
before you lower the boom.
That's right. Very good. Awesome. Well, thank you so much for being here today. And, bringing a little levity to a serious subject, and I appreciate the work that you're doing in the world because it is definitely needed. So thank you so much.
Well, it's very therapeutic. People ask, you know, is it difficult to talk about? No, it's extremely therapeutic knowing you're helping people. I mean, it's just, you know, it's my why.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I appreciate you again. Thank you for being here, and thank everyone out there who is listening and watching, and make sure you go check out the show notes for some of the, I'll have all the links to Frank's website, and you'll be able to get that information there. And until next time, as always, I encourage you to go out and live fully, love deeply, and engage authentically.
One more thing before you go. As a valued listener of the Live, Love, Engage podcast, I want to help you shine your light in the world, not only while you're listening to the show, but all day, every day of the week. That's why I created the Live, Love, Engage Spiritual Awakening Community on Facebook. It's a place for you to gather with other business professionals and entrepreneurs who are committed to living the life of their dreams. If you want to be a part of this community and receive free trainings from me, go to liveloveengage.com and request to join. That's liveloveengage.com.